How's it going, everyone? You are listening to Fluid, a podcast series that explores queerness in its entirety and the lost connections between all of us, queer or not. My name is Nick, and everybody, this is the season finale. I can't believe it. Honestly, it feels like yesterday I was bricking putting the first episode out, and now I'm sitting here in my bedroom. It's spring, and yeah, series one is coming to a close. So we're rounding off exploring rural queer life. Now, rural queer experiences are barely shed light on, and I think really this is for a lot of reasons. I mean, in the UK and Britain, there's a historic and influential divide between the North and the South, and a strong cultural preference, let's say, for urban stories, especially in the capital of London. And I think this leaves many people, queer or not, feeling less represented in our nation's identity. Now, for queer people, this is a whole other kettle of fish, and that's what we're going to unpack in today's episode. So today, sorry, there's a loud moped outside. Can you bugger off? So today, I'm joined by Lucy Mooring, who is a Warwick undergrad student and researcher whose project, Now as Queer as Folk, explores the intersections of rural queer life and being a queer woman. Our conversation was beautiful and reinforced to me something my suburban arse had failed to consider, that people, queer or not, might have a deep-rooted connection to the land that they were raised in. Not only this, but there's a rather lazy assumption that rural equals conservative, homophobic and close-minded. Now, although this can often be the case, because it's in the built-up urban environments that culture can evolve rapidly, we have to stop making this assumption. A little bit later on in today's episode, I'm going to be talking about gay farmers and a UK-based gay farmers helpline that in itself really drives home the reality of queer experiences. You cannot define them. Any job that is occupied by someone straight is also occupied by someone queer. You know, I honestly feel like I'm going to be in this line of research and work for the rest of my life, because to me, there's no finish line. I want to live in a society where, regardless of your race, gender, sexuality, class, you can live a life that suits you. You know, it's not just about making sure there's progressive spaces in city centres, it's about making sure queer kids from all walks of life, from all places in the country and the world, can follow their heart. So on that note, let's jump into our interview with Lucy. So I wanted to start by asking her, Now as Queer as Folk, where did that name come from?
I guess, yeah, I've always kind of been aware of that saying and of that phrase, Now as Queer as Folk, or sometimes Now So Queer as Folk, and of it being a pretty popular common phrase. Like in Yorkshire, we kind of have it on like tea towels and stuff, and it kind of means there's nothing as weird as people, and obviously the use of the queer in that term is not necessarily a positive term, but I like playing with and reclaiming it and understanding it in the sense of, yeah, there is nothing as weird as people. Yeah. And also understanding how, yeah, that, like, how strange and varied our representations and understandings of queer are, and that doesn't have to be a bad thing. So yeah, that's what the term means. So I guess I started from just trying to represent and understand the my experience of being a queer woman from a rural space and from being from rural North Yorkshire. So it originally just came from that place of wanting to seek to represent rural space, kind of being frustrated at the representations of rural space that was in the media and in most like narratives, which depicted like solely as homophobic, solely as a space that you kind of want to escape from. And, you know, I've been frustrated about my own experiences of not feeling like I fitted into a scene, or, you know, not feeling like queer enough because you weren't really in an urban space. And then I guess as I started researching more and more, I started to realise how common that experience is and how misrepresented our histories are. Yeah, and just trying to kind of disrupt that binary between rural and urban, and trying to kind of go away with the idea that you have to necessarily evoke any kind of space or like spatial understanding of ourselves to be fully queer. Like most rural people feel very like pressured to move to an urban space. I don't think that's always necessarily a positive thing, because I think it can be just so pressurized, and it can lead to, unfortunately, things like gentrification, where people, you know, those spaces unfortunately become very through like cis white gay kind of, those spaces can become very affluent, very like desired, and unfortunately push out people who aren't, you know, who don't fit into those types.
Yeah, absolutely.
Categories. I think for a lot of queer people, for example, like the home could be a huge site of trauma and violence, and that's not necessarily something that is like inherent to that space. For me, like this kind of growing up in quite a homophobic environment, I never saw it as being related to being in a rural space, even though it was kind of rural and isolated. And maybe it would have been easier to escape that homophobia if I was in an urban space, but I think the main site of that problem was the home, and the home is such a huge site of, you know, the nuclear family is such a huge site of violence for queer people, and I think that's something that unites us all regardless of where we are.
Yeah, ultimately the lack of representation, you know, has all these unwanted consequences. And, you know, when Lucy started speaking about the home, this is a crucial point, and it really made me think, as a queer person, what really bonds us all together?
I think when I started to use the internet, be on Tumblr, that's probably my main social media. It's probably done a lot of, like, lost a lot of brain cells on there, but also found like a community of people, began to understand my experiences were, gave me the language as well. Like, when you don't have the language to understand yourself, that's such a, it's a really difficult thing to understand, isn't it? Yeah, but I've, the friends that I met online when I was like 16, I'm still friends with them now. And so that's a really nice thing. Like, it's just, I feel like really united with a lot of other queer people in these, who came from pretty like secluded, isolated places, and we're kind of all united online, which is really nice.
Yeah, I mean, when Lucy mentions the internet, it again reminded me of where we're at generationally. You know, I think if we were to zoom out of this universe and look at time from further away, the birth of the internet would be visible from a distance, honey. You know, it's just been so influential in connecting people across the world, and developing these internet personas has helped us understand ourselves and find community. It made me think of Glitch Feminism, which is a book written by curator and writer Legacy Russell, a Black queer femme from New York. Legacy opens her book by introducing readers to her internet username LovePunk12, and explores how her use of internet provided an escape from the increasingly gentrified and isolating neighbourhood of East Village in New York. You know, the more people I talk to and things I read and come across, every single queer person with access to the internet seems to have a story to tell about the solace that has been found in these spaces.
Did you have any queer friends growing up out of interest, like, or maybe you were one out at the time, but...
No, so I came out when I was 16, like, as soon as I left school, that summer where you leave school, like, where you've done your exams, I was like, I just kind of re-examined my whole life, and I was like, oh my god, I was an awful person in school, and, you know, I did have those prejudices about what I, you know, I didn't really understand myself. I was kind of, you know, that really, like, cliche example of, you know, I used to get changed in the kind of toilets in the PE changing rooms because I didn't want to get dressed in front of other girls, and I didn't want to be seen to look at them, and was kind of uncomfortable with my desires, and so yeah, I'd literally lock myself away, and I probably did have horrible, like, probably think bad things about queer people at the time because I was suppressing that side of myself. I didn't really want to understand.
Yeah, Lucy talking about changing rooms and struggling with queerness in school really resonated with me. I know it would resonate with a lot of other queer people out there. And I think it really drives home how important representation is. That's really why I think, well, LGBTQ plus education needs to be mandatory in school, because we need to give kids all over the country an understanding, a frame of reference. You know, what keeps coming up time and time again in what Lucy has said, in what so many of us have said this whole time, is not having the language to understand yourself is a really disorientating time in childhood. You know, it's this thing that you're aware of and you can kind of laugh about it when you're older by being like, oh my God. Like for me, I was obsessed. I mean, I've spoken about a few of my crushes, but one of them was Kate Blanchett. I bloody love Kate Blanchett. And, you know, I fancied all these people, I just didn't have the language. And it's just, I think we need to really equip our youth with a framework of understanding. That's going to help our mental health.
But to see like a few years later, I know like a lot of people, some people at school like went to prom together, two girls. And that was just like, I remember looking at it thinking, wow, that's such a improvement. And it's such a nice thing that these communities are kind of evolving and growing, which is, because I don't, you know, I don't think that space was inherently homophobic. I don't think any, they were inherently had those prejudices or ideas. It's just, I don't know, when you don't have the representation, when you don't have the language, and also just like a lot of prejudice is kind of growing from hostility of homophobia of times before, like, you know, Sex in 28, things like that was still very, you know, it had only really been repealed a few years before I started high school. So I still think it had a really lingering effect.
What are your kind of feelings and thoughts towards rural spaces, and how does that connect to your identity as a queer person?
Yeah, it's interesting because I guess as queer people, we're kind of positioned to be against nature and, you know, like we're not natural, and that's just not my understanding of how I view myself as a queer person.
Yeah, so beautiful. I couldn't agree more. Now, I think this is... this is why I honestly love the internet, because I came across a person called Joe Crowdy, who, among many things, writes on architecture. Now, he's written two pieces that I have read about the relationship between weeds, as in the garden, and queer people, talking about the sexual landscape of a garden. Now, give me a second if you're like, what the hell are you talking about? Because it's amazing what he's written. And I guess nature is brimming with sex. You know, any natural environment is this luscious and overbearing and encroaching space teeming with fertilization and reproduction. Crowdy explores the manicured and presentational nature of gardens and talks about how weeds are the arch nemesis of a gardener. The weeds are the threat to the human's take on nature. The weed resembles that which is the undergrowth, that which cannot be tamed, that which disturbs the Garden of Eden. His paper Queer Undergrowth explores the pleasure gardens in Vauxhall in the 1800s and how this was a place of flirtation and courtship. It makes me think, actually, sometimes when I see flowers and nature, it does remind me of sex. It reminds me that we as living beings, whether plants or humans, are constantly reproducing and enticing each other as living organisms. But in this respect, queerness is seen as an obstruction because, as queer people, though not always, we're not always reproducing. But that in itself is what I find beautiful. To enjoy the fruits of this world, the sensations, the moments, without the pressure to do it in the name of creation. As we explore with Deblina, you know, this is valid and this is a real experience that has existed since the beginning of time. Weeds grow where they are not wanted. As Crowdy writes, a weed also possesses particular innate characteristics that set it apart from respectable plants. The growth of weeds is obscenely vigorous. It grows wild and rank, displaying a rampant vitality, quite shocking to civilized eyes. Wow, I mean, I just love that quote. I think so often as queer people, we are desperate to be those pruned flowers in the garden, to be the rose, which, by the way, we are. But we are also the wild, the untamed, the free. We are the threat to the perfect, to the nuclear, the right. Because if the whole world was perfectly manicured, we'd be living in the Truman Show. It's the undergrowth that makes us feel free. It's the untarnished, the unstoppable force of nature, of trees, of forests, of vines that cradle us and loosen our spirit. Okay, let's hop back in with Lucy. Enough of that.
No, I see myself as very embedded in nature, and I always feel really at home in nature. And it's a kind of like this sense of homecoming and of, like I say, I didn't necessarily have the best childhood in the sense of like the actual physical presence of home, but in the sense of like I feel very at home in nature. And a lot of people view rural space, I think, as being very conservative, very homophobic, because unfortunately we've had this really disrupted history with rural space, because, you know, since the kind of invention of capitalism, we kind of had that land seized from us. You know, this land used to be communal, it used to be our land, and, you know, used to work on it, we used to see kind of a very physical connection to that space and land. And now, unfortunately, in particularly still in England, like still so much of that space is privatized, so much of it isn't public. You know, you're kind of very aware of that if you're in the countryside, you know, this which space isn't and isn't yours, you know, like what's a public footpath, what isn't. And
yeah, what Lucy is talking about here is really interesting, and if anyone's interested in the kind of history of Britain, it's fucking interesting, I can't lie. I mean, all our land used to be communal. The privatization of land was life as we know it now. And I think it is quite interesting to explore the kind of antiquity, the ancient, you know, ness, for lack of a better word, you know, of the connection between people and land, especially in rural places.
And I think it's important, I think, for queer people, I guess, just to start to try to see rural space as something that can be for us and that can be for everyone and should be something that's celebrated.
How have you found for that to be true for you?
I guess, yeah, I think I've just started to try and embrace more. I guess when I was younger, there might have been more of this, when you're unhappy in a space, you kind of want to distance yourself completely from anything to do with that. And I think the last few years, I've just tried to try and relearn and reconfigure that relationship. So to understand that, you know, for example, like Yorkshire, like I really love being in Yorkshire now. Like, kind of going home for me is not, like I say, not really about the people there or like that a home space in physical sense, but rather like just the bounty of the land, of being in that space, of just walking, of swimming, of just really physically being very present there. I'm especially a huge fan of like North Yorkshire moors, of the Dales, of like where there is, I don't know, you can, I think those places can make you feel really alone, and I do understand why people might be a bit freaked out because it's just you there. But as I started to re-understand myself more and started to like myself more as a person, I'm like, oh, I'm actually kind of okay with being by myself. And I don't need noise or things going on. I can just be in this desolate space, and that's cool and that's fine.
This reminds me of Brokeback Mountain, to be honest, for which, for God's sake, if you've not read, you need to read it. It's a short story by the American author Annie Proulx, and you might have seen the film, but it's just incredible. And it's a love story between two gay cowboys. But yeah, this sense of immersion in nature is similar to themes we've explored in previous episodes. Nature doesn't judge. And that is a really, really beautiful feeling that every queer should be able to experience. I think this is a great time to come back in and talk about gay farmers. Now, I've come across a great gay farmers helpline from a BBC interview, which I will link on the Google Doc that I have on my Instagram page. It was started by a guy called Keith Innison, from Cheshire, based in Northern Ireland, who set up the Gay Farmers Helpline in 2010, which is the only service of its kind in the UK, to support men in isolated rural communities struggling with their sexuality. You know, he came out at 50, he said. He's has a background in agriculture and began realising that he wasn't alone. So in setting up this helpline, which in a way, to go back to the weed analogy, an undergrowth analogy for a second, this web, this invisible web that exists in every space, brings queers together who, you know, however hidden, need a support network. I mean, as much as I'm all for this gay men's helpline, it does just go to show, and this is something that's come up time and time again, that there are so many more services and opportunities for gay men than there are for other queer people, other queer identities. And I really think that this is something that we need to change. We need it for everybody.
You know, we can't just stop there.
Yeah, then I guess I started college and I remember meeting the first queer person. Like, they're kind of, I don't think they were out as non-binary at the time, but since then I've come out as non-binary. But yeah, I remember we always laugh about now because looking back, we were like, obviously we very much liked each other, but we didn't know really what to do about it. We were like kind of useless gays about it. And we would have things that were like dates, but we didn't really understand them as dates. So I remember we went to watch Carol. We were quite drunk and then we were just like, we'd always have sleepovers and stuff. And it was like, we literally went to go see like the most lesbian film of all time. And we just still didn't really have that understanding that, you know, maybe we liked each other in kind of a way that was a bit romantic and sexual and things. But yeah, I think college was a much better time for me. You know, we had actually these explicitly kind of left-wing progressive spaces. We had a feminist society at my college, which was really cool. Yeah, and just more diverse representations as well, what we were studying. Like, I remember at college, like, I think we studied Othello, and I remember always trying to shoehorn in like a gay angle on that. Like, oh, why is this man so obsessed with another man in such like, you know, like, why does he seem to hate himself for it? And, you know, my teacher didn't really like it that much. She was like, I don't understand. Like, why do you have to keep making everything gay? But, you know, some things are gay. Maybe Shakespeare is pretty gay.
So, yeah, like, I wonder how do you feel about rewriting like the rural queer narrative? Like, how is that important in what you do?
I like that phrasing a bit about rewriting it, because I think it, in some ways it is written, but it's not something that you necessarily, I don't know, yeah, it's not something that we really want written on the record, and it doesn't have to be that way, the way that it's written currently, which is something that is, I don't know, yeah, it's something that's just kind of a frustrated narrative, very like overdone, the narrative that that always has to be evoked when understanding rural space. So I guess, yeah, something that I definitely want to do is to try and re-understand. And there are so many people doing that. I think Instagram's a really great way of seeing that, especially in the rural South of America. There are so many people reclaiming cowboys, reclaiming space, reclaiming like very physical manual labor in a way that's super interesting. I hope that my work does try to rewrite that narrative. And just try to resist this idea that if you want to be queer, then, or you are queer, that you have to be in an urban space, that you have to build your identity around those spaces. And I really hope, especially I think our generation is getting a lot better at just starting to understand the limits of those narratives and of how we can actually build our identities and communities in a way that's much more suited to us and much more representative of such are like varied histories.
You know, I think this is actually a really beautiful place to wrap up, to be honest. Or at least, thank you, Lucy, for joining us. Oh wait, Lucy, where can people find you?
Or not find you?
yeah, I'm pretty much always on Twitter. My @ is Lucy Mooring, and I'm on Instagram @ Queer Archivist.
Yeah, I'm really happy we finished here, to be honest, with series one, because I think it drives home my key desires. LGBTQIA+ education needs to be mandatory at school. Representation is probably the most important thing when it comes to giving queer people a good quality of life, giving queer people an opportunity to have good mental health, supportive relationships with their family, and to do what we can as a society to expel shame that every queer goes through. Queer people are just the same as everyone. We want the same things. We want choices, freedom, love, family, safety. A chance to give what we want in life a shot, to go for it, to be an artist, a farmer, a historian, a doctor, a sex worker, a marketing director, you know, a charity worker. We should, all of us, no matter what our kind of position in this life, we should have access to these opportunities. So I call on the government. Enact mandatory LGBTQ+ education, right your wrongs from section 28. Medical reform, allow queer people access to healthcare we need, both physically and mentally. And I call on all straight people listening to hold us gently, to try your best to understand what you do not experience. And to every single queer person listening, I love you. I love you fundamentally because you and I share this special, special love. Please hear me when I say that you are precious, just as you are. However much you feel you conform or do not conform to societal standards, this isn't the end of our journey together. It's just the beginning. This space was always meant for you to feel seen and understood in. I hope, and honestly, I pray every night that I can continue to facilitate that. Now listen, you can find me, you can contact me whenever you want, okay? At podcastfluid@gmail.com and on Instagram, fluidpodcast, because I couldn't get two of the same. Listen, speak soon. I love you. Take care.